So what is it? What is it that you want out of life? What are the big things on your agenda, on your list of what you would like? If I asked that question when the children were here, I would probably get an answer, at least from my own son, of a PlayStation. Maybe some of you have your sights set a little, I don't know if it's higher or lower. Maybe it's a new pair of trainers. Maybe you fancy a new set of wheels. Anyone want one of those? Or you're more practical and down to earth. Just a nice little modest house that you'd like. Nothing tasteless about that, is there? Is that what you'd like out of life? The mansion? The statement house? Oh, what about one of those? Looks nice. You could have fun on that, couldn't you? A nice yacht. Or maybe that's more your style, the sailing yacht. What's the attraction of these things? Why are people interested in them? Why will people part with vast sums of money to have a car that will do 200 miles an hour when the speed limit is 70? And realistically, you can't go that much faster. Who really needs the number of rooms in a house like that one I showed you a minute ago? Even if you've got an army of cleaners, how are you going to find your glasses or your car keys when you've put them down in a room and you can't remember which room you left them in? Why do people buy these cars, these yachts? Why do they build these houses? I think most of us would agree that, to some extent, it's not about the practicalities. It's not about the need to drive at 200 miles an hour, because you can't, actually. It's not about the need to have all those rooms in your house, because actually you just lose stuff. It's about telling everyone else about ourselves. It's making a statement. And what's the message that we want to tell? Well, the message, I think, for many, is that I am a success. That I've achieved all this. That I've done it. That my house is bigger and better. And most importantly, more expensive than yours is. Than everyone else's is. Or than the average is. If you go around and ask people whether they think that a really big house, like the one I put on the screen, will make them happy, what do you think they'll say? I think most people will say, no, it won't. Most people know that stuff doesn't make you happy. Even if you go up to Canary Wharf and ask an investment banker, most of them will tell you that how fast their car goes or how many rooms that they have in their house isn't important in itself. It's just a way of keeping the score, checking that they're more successful than their colleagues and rivals. And in our more thoughtful moments, most of us, even investment bankers, know that money and possessions don't make you happy. They don't provide fulfillment. They don't give you satisfaction. If you want to check, here's a guy who knows a thing or two about success and money. He doesn't always look like that, but that's Jim Carrey. Jim Carrey is one of the most famous people on our planet. He's been the star of more films than I can count, and in the process, he's earned himself vast amounts of money. He's not just in the 1%, he's in the 0.00000 out of many 1%. And this is what he says. I think everyone should get rich and famous and do everything that ever they dreamed of so they can see that it's not the answer. Now, really, I'm not saying anything controversial. Certainly this isn't controversial in church. And really, even in our society in general, it's not that outrageous. Everybody pretty much pays at least lip service to the idea that money doesn't buy you happiness. But still, in April this year, the average UK household had debts of £58,240. As part of that £58,000, the average UK household owed just under £7,700 of unsecured debt. That's the bit that's not your mortgage. So that's £7,700 of credit card debt, of personal loans, maybe car finance. It's a lot of money. That amount of debt means that the UK is paying around £50 billion every year in interest. £139 million of interest every day. So it seems that as a society, we're pretty dedicated to testing the theory that possessions can't make you happy, just in case it's not true. But it's not my purpose this morning. I'm not here to talk about how many you feel guilty about your spending or your debts, if you've got them. I'm more interested in what really drives you, what really motivates you, what's really important to you. What is it that gets you out of your bed tomorrow morning? And tomorrow morning is Monday morning, in case you needed reminding. What is it that will get you out of the house? For some of you, the answer is probably very clear. It's your mum, who will get you out of bed and make you your breakfast and drag you to school. But for most of us, what is it that gets us out of bed every morning? Maybe it's just because I'm getting old. But I'm interested in dreams, particularly in dreams that fade. On Thursday, big event starting. Thursday, the World Cup will kick off in Russia. A lot of men, and it is usually men, can remember the moment when the national team first had a player in it who was younger than they were. It's a bit of a defining moment for many of us. It happens to be England national team. But there's an even worse moment when you discover that you're older than every single player in the squad, even the goalkeeper. For many of us, it's just that faint echo of a door slamming forever when they're all younger than you are. I felt it, and I'm not even any good at football. For many of us, there are moments in our life, in our lives, when possibilities, however wildly realistic they were, like me playing for England, when possibilities finally close forever. The moment when you realise that your boss is younger than you are, that you're never going to run the company, that you've had your last big promotion and your income's going to stay where it is. Sometimes these possibilities are more poignant. Sometimes they really touch us where it hurts. The realization that it's getting less and less likely that you'll ever marry. The steadily diminishing likelihood as the years go past of having children. Most of us start out as young people with big, although often undefined, ambitions. But on Monday morning, tomorrow morning, how many of us are going out to change the world? Well, I hope you weren't expecting that it would be fun to come to church on Sunday just to listen to me pouring out my midlife crisis. But it's not just me. This isn't just a midlife crisis. These questions are relevant to all of us. If you are still young, if you've got life ahead of you, if life is still full of possibilities, of all of these possibilities, what will those possibilities deliver? To go back to where we started, even if the promotions come and they get you a bigger pay packet, and they get you all the things that come with that pay packet, then what? We've already said, at the end of the day, it doesn't bring happiness. It doesn't bring fulfillment. They don't bring satisfaction. How many people really get to change the world, to really make a difference so that their name lives on for generations after? And of those, how many of them change the world in a good way? So now, now that I've depressed you all, I want to tell you a story. It's a story from the Bible. Actually, it's the one that we've already read, that Peter read to us. And it's the one that we've already quoted from during the dedication of Estelle. And when I read this story, it's kind of it's a passage that people speak on at dedications, because, as we mentioned earlier, at the end of it, there's a child who is taken to the house of God to be presented there, to be dedicated. But I found this story more disturbing than I expected. It prompted the questions that we started with this morning. So the story is about a guy who lived a very long time ago in Israel. And his name was Elkanah, but you don't really have to remember his name because he's not the main character here. Elkanah probably didn't look like that, but he had two wives, and that's what's important. And that used to happen a lot in those days. And some of you are probably thinking, two wives. And those of you who are already married thinking, two wives? Is this guy crazy? One of the wives was called Peninnah. I think it's that one. But you don't need to remember her name either, really, because she's not that important either, to be honest. And she had lots of children with Elkanah. And the other wife was called Hannah. And that's her there. And the story is mostly about her. So Hannah's the one you need to remember. She was the favorite wife. Now, my mother told me when I was young that when I had children, you shouldn't have favorites amongst your children. She didn't give me any advice about having favorites amongst your wives, but I'm guessing that on the same principle, it isn't a great idea. But Hannah was the favorite wife. She was the one that Elkanah loved. And that's a really important thing about her. But the really important thing about her defines her for this story is that she didn't have any children. And in those days, in that society, having children was a really, really big deal. It's such a big deal that you can't overstate how big a deal it was. It was your children who ensured that your name lived on after you. Children, again, as we read during the dedication, children were a gift from God. Having children was the big deal. Now, luckily, Elkanah, the guy, had another wife, as we've already said, with whom he had children. So he's okay. But for Hannah, not having children wasn't okay. If your society thinks that the main aim of your life is to produce babies, and the years go past, and no babies come, where does that leave you? And it's such a public thing. Poor Hannah had nowhere to hide. And people in that society would have said, well, why doesn't she have children? Her childlessness was seen as God's judgment, as a punishment from God. People around her would have known that if she hasn't got children, God's judging her. She must be a bad person in some way. Even though they didn't know what she was doing wrong, somewhere, somehow, they were confident that she was a bad person, a sinner. Because if she wasn't, she would have children. In those days, in that place, in that time, not having children, so much more than a secret sorrow. It was a public shame. And it was made worse because the other wife, probably and understandably jealous because she wasn't the favorite, she would wind her up. She would mock Hannah about not having children. And as every year went past, the door closed a little bit more. As every year passed and Hannah got older, that door was closing more firmly on the possibility, on the chances of Hannah having a child. And as the hope faded, the meaninglessness of Hannah's life was underlined. You can tell when you read the passage the impact it had on her. This shame was such that she could take no pleasure in anything else. When Peter read it, we read that her husband would come to her and say, but I love you. Doesn't that matter to you? Am I not? My love is more than 10 children. And she could find no pleasure in that. It didn't make up for her childlessness. it couldn't take away the shame. Wow, this is an upbeat sermon, isn't it? Aren't you glad you came to rejoice with Lewis and Vida this morning? But it doesn't end there. So what does Hannah do? Well, every year the whole family went up to worship and to sacrifice at the place where God's altar was. And every year Hannah was part of that, because the whole family would go. And presumably every year she would go and she would pray. She would ask God, especially, for a child, for a son. But is the expectation, the hope, the optimism died, little by little, year after year? We get to a year when our story takes place. And in our story this year, the whole family go up to sacrifice again. And Hannah is there again. And this year, the desperation is just too much. The other wife, you may have noticed, the Bible calls her a rival. The other wife was mocking her, and it was too much. And she went into the place of worship, the house of the Lord, and she prayed. And she prayed with bitter tears. And she prayed for a child. And she promised God that if he gave her a son, she would dedicate this child to him. In other words, you give me a son, and I'll give him straight back to you. And her pain was such that although she was praying silently in her head, her lips were moving. And the priest, the high priest, thought she was drunk. So just to make her misery complete, as she's pouring out her sorrows to the Lord, God's representative, the high priest, accuses her of being drunk in the place of worship. If you think you've had bad days, think about Hannah. She explains to the priest that she's a troubled woman, pouring out her soul to God. And the high priest accepts the story and says, "May God grant you what you've asked of him." And this is an interesting part. It sounds to me, when you read it, that the high priest's words are just a formula. May God give you what you ask. But Hannah finds encouragement in them. And it tells us that she went away, and her face was no longer downcast. Well, even if you didn't know the story already, you could probably guess what happens next. Hannah gets pregnant. And 9 months later, a baby boy is born. Then comes a bit that's kind of hard to take. She keeps this little boy, whom she names Samuel, at home until he's not breastfeeding anymore. And then, to keep the promise that she made when she prayed, she takes him up to the place of worship the next time they go. And she leaves him there, in God's house, to be a servant in the temple, to be brought up by the priests. And so this child, this little boy, we don't know exactly how old, but maybe 3 years old, is handed over by his mother to be brought up by the priests to serve in the house of the Lord. Well, it doesn't feel quite like the happy ending that we were hoping for. Maybe you expect. Hannah longed for a baby. She prayed for one with bitter tears. Her wish was finally granted. The child lived happily ever after, but miles away, and brought up by someone else. And it says that she got to see him once a year. So this story, it begins, not recorded, but you can kind of... It's implicit in the story that the story begins with Hannah as a blushing bride in a white dress walking down the aisle. And I know that they didn't walk down aisles in white dresses in those days, but she was walking down the aisle full of hopes and dreams of life with the man she loved. She's a girl who's already experienced success in life. She found a good husband and a man who loved her. Well, it's not nothing. And she's looking forward at the start of the story to building a family together with him. And then those dreams, they never shatter. They're never destroyed by a sudden, short, sharp shock. They just wither gently. As the months turn into years, and the years begin to mount up, and no baby comes. And as the dreams wither, she confronts disappointment, but also the shame, the absolute humiliation of her public failure to have a child. She's a girl, a woman, no worse than her neighbours, but who seems to that society to be one who is judged by God for her sins. She's labelled the sinner. And when she takes her misery to God, she doesn't complain that it just seems unjust. Because it does, to be honest. I felt that. When I read it, I feel it just seems so unfair. She's no worse, it says. I mean, the passage doesn't give us any indication that she's any worse than anyone else. She doesn't complain. She doesn't say, "Why me, God?" She pours out her misery and promises God that if he will give her a son, she'll hand the baby back. And so she experiences a few precious months with this baby. And then, as promised, hands him over to the priests. And that probably seems cruel to you. It does to me, if I'm honest. She's given a child through all those years of waiting. She's given a child to hand it back a couple of years later. What's going on? Well, you have to understand the logic of the story. Hannah's problem here, Hannah's issue, is the shame, the humiliation that she bears, that she's been labelled as someone under God's judgment, and that her existence without children is to Hannah and to the people around her essentially meaningless. The child she was given, the child removed that shame. The child took away that label, the label of sinner. The child gave her life meaning. That with Samuel she didn't get to experience all the joys and terrors of motherhood is, in the logic of the story, not the big thing. As I said earlier, you can't overstate how important it was for Hannah that she didn't have a child. How desperate her condition was. How shameful it was for her in the society in which she lived. And therefore, you can't overstate how big a thing it is for Hannah that she had a baby, that she had a child, that she was given a son. Her life was given meaning. Her shame was taken away. It's almost like she was receiving a new life with the birth of this child. Now, if you read on, and by the way, as I mentioned earlier, the story is in, or as Peter mentioned earlier, the story is in the first chapter of the book of 1 Samuel. It is worth a read. It's a really good story. If you read on into chapter 2, you'll find that actually, subsequently, she did give birth to other children. And with them, she did get to share the full experience of motherhood. That isn't the point here. When Samuel, her first child, is born, the stigma goes away. Her existence is kind of validated. And she receives her new life. After that, she is free. She's free to have more children, and to nurture them, and to bring them up, and to enjoy them. But she's free not to have any more children, and still to be able to walk out with her head held high. No longer the sinner, the failure. With the birth of Samuel, Hannah becomes a free woman. Now, I'm aware of the risks of this story, and I want to emphasize that this story is set in a very specific time, in a very specific context. That society said that Hannah's life was in some ways had meaning if she had children. That is not what the Bible teaches. It is not what we believe. But I hope that although it's very time specific, it's set in a particular place, a particular time, a particular culture, I hope you can see the connection between Hannah's situation And some of the questions that I talked about earlier. Hannah's an extreme case. Because of her society, because of the particular beliefs that society had, she's a really, really extreme case. Not realizing her aspirations, not realizing her dreams, was literally tragic in her life. Most of us don't find it's like that. Most of us find that as our aspirations shrink, as our dreams become narrower, smaller, we're not exposed to public humiliation like Hannah was. But if we're honest, most of us, at times, I think, try to avoid the nagging question of what is life for? Of what am I? What is Monday morning all about? What am I doing? Why do I get up to go to work? To spend the day in an office, in a school, a college, wherever you spend your day? What does it mean? What's it for? So let's shift the focus from one particular place, one particular context, one particular time-bound problem of the very public shame that Hannah knew. Let's come away from the world of ancient Israel 3,500 years ago, small village life, from the ancient world of the Middle East and the Mediterranean. What does this story do for the rest of us in a world that maybe seems not so much tragic, although sometimes it is, but just futile? What do we do with this story? Why is it here? Why is it in the Bible? Well, the point of the story, I think, is that Hannah was given a child. And it was a child which was, in some sense, it was her child. But in another sense, it wasn't quite hers in the same way that another child is. It was a child given to her for a very specific purpose. A child to take away her shame. To take away this label of sinner, person judged by God. A child given to make her free. And in the same way that a child, a son, was God's answer to Hannah's need, a child, a son, is the answer to all our needs, not our own child. But as the book of Isaiah says, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. To all of us, whether you have children, whether you don't, whether you'd like to have children, whether you can think of nothing worse, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. But this child, the child who is the center of the big story of the Bible, this child is God's own son, given to take away my shame, to take away your shame, given to remove our sin, and given to make us free. The big story of the Bible, and Hannah's story, the point of it is to point forward to this story. The big story of the Bible is that God gave his own son, Jesus, and that his death, his resurrection, paid the price that justice demands for my sin and my shame, and your sin and your shame. And it's in relationship with him that he offers that we find that life has meaning. But life has purpose. And so, if you know him, on Monday morning, you're free. You're free to go out and change the world and really make a difference to people in your neighborhood, in your office, the next door desk, or to go out and change the whole world to really make an impact, to become famous. But you're free also to lead a quiet life, to make that difference only in a small area, to do your work and to live your life. And it isn't meaningless and it isn't pointless. Because whether you're changing the world in a visible way or whether you just change light bulbs for a living, whatever you do, you're doing it walking with and walking alongside the God of the universe. Now that is good news. Amen? And it brings me back to where we started. As we celebrate this morning, the gift of life, the gift of Estelle to Lewis and to Vida, to Io, and in some sense to all of us as her community and as the wider community of friends and family of Lewis and Vida and Io and Estelle. We know that already they have their prayer, their hopes and their dreams and their prayers for her. And we know that as Estelle grows up, she will definitely have a mind of her own. And she will add her own hopes and her own aspirations to that mix. But our prayer and our hope for Estelle this morning is that whatever great thing she does, whether on the public stage under the spotlight, or quietly in some small corner, she does them walking alongside the God of the universe, the God who gave his child, his son, for her and for you, for all of us, to take away her sin, her shame, and to give her